Hello. My name is like Bambi and okay, I am blonde. Like people think that just because I am blonde that I am like stupid. That is like so untrue. I like graduated from high school and everything and I'm like intelligent, articulate, and I have a vocabulary as big as like whatever. And as for all this talk about sex, I do not have sex with just anybody. They have to be men. And not like the whole football team either, just the starters. So before you go around saying bad things about blondes like me, you should like find out more about the person inside. Like not the stuff inside a person, you know, like your guts and stuff. That would be so grody.
There are millions of blondes across the country.
Ew, who even wants to think about that?
And the numbers continue to grow.
Like, what were we talking about?
Please, help them.
I'm sorry, I am like totally spaced here.
A message from the National Institute of the Blonde. Venice Beach, California, 60609.
Like, are you still going to pay me for this? Because my credit card is like totally maxed out and I could really use the money, you know?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Who Scares Us and Why. Mark Stein examines American political panics over witches, Indians, Masons, Chinese, socialists, Latinos, Muslims, gay marriage, and more. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
You mentioned the newsman Howard K. Smith, and he was a newsman at another time before the 24/7 news cycle.
Sure.
So my question is, let's make up a news organization. If there were such a news organization as called Fox,
mm-hmm.
who had a lot of people that
were
interested in it,
kind of music,
entertainment agency rather than news. No, but on a serious point, do you see the 24/7 news cycle having any effect on panic? Increasing, decreasing? Is it different now, say, than 1897 when a letter, you know, would take 4 days to reach across the country?
Right. So. Absolutely, I think that media outlets such as Fox do contribute to panic. That part, yes. Is it different? It's interesting you said it's different now than, I think you said, 1897. Actually, 1897, no. And the point I want to make by saying no is all of us in this room, I think, we live in a certain bubble in some respects. Maybe it's not a bubble. Time will tell. But in somewhat, we're at kind of the closing phase for the, at least for now, of in journalism. That was not really always the case. And I'm not a journalistic historian, so don't hold me to every phrase that I use. I call it, loosely, the Edward R. Murrow School of Journalism. Murrow was a great broadcaster for CBS during the war, and then in the years that followed the war, and a great number of newscasters followed, well, really grew up under him and followed in his footsteps. I don't want to credit him with creating this, but he's my kind of shorthand for the notion that the news media, newspapers, television news, you know, mass media news, should try for it to be as objective as possible in reporting the news and to separate editorial from news content as best as humanly possible. But in fact, in the history of American journalism, that's unusual. I'll give an example from when I was working on this book, and I would be reading pieces from the New York Herald from the 1840s and 50s. My wife works at the Newspaper Periodical Division, Library of Congress. And I said to her, what's with the New York Herald? They're like so pro-slavery. They're like, everything about the South is like, you know, they're New York. And she said, well, you have to understand, Wall Street was financing the cotton trade in this country, the whole international cotton trade. They had deep economic interests tied to this Southern industry, and New York Herald was their voice, whereas other newspapers in New York were the voice of this group or that. There's that phrase, yellow journalism. Journalists, for the larger part of our history, have been anything but factual. I had to be very careful when I wrote this book, and I cite a lot of newspapers, to make it clear that just because I'm reading something, quoting something from a newspaper, doesn't mean it really happened that way. Because they were, well, like Fox, and you can't be sure that just because some newspaper in Montana said this about Mother Jones during some labor dispute, that in fact Mother Jones did that or not.
An excellent answer, but just a quick follow-up on that. some people believe that a person on TV is more believed, not believable, but more believed. So I guess, well, what you say is absolutely 100% true.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the scope of the audience, I guess I'm saying.
Right.
And so would it be easier to create a panic today if someone decided to use the media than it would have been in some of the historic things you do? Do you think it would make a difference or it wouldn't?
That's a good question. I don't know back in the day how much the average reader ascribed validity to something that they read in the New York Herald.
Right.
Or was it more like something that in the 50s and 60s, a Russian, from what I understand, would read Pravda with, you know, kind of a jaundiced view. Not all Russians, but there were some. But clearly, you know, it gets to, in a way, correlation causing assumption. Our correlation of information we get from a guy shouting on a corner is they tend not to be accurate. Our correlation of something we read in the Washington Post or the New York Times is they tend to be right. As you say, you see it on TV, we still kind of correlate that less today than we did 20 years ago because of places like Fox. Gee, they tend to be right. There's a wonderful book called The Tipping Point where Malcolm Gladwell talks about messengers and how sticky the message really gets very much to what Gladwell's talking about who's the most effective messenger.
Surviving Progress. Ronald Wright joins Pia Chattopadhyay to discuss what contemporary policymakers and economists can do to alleviate the pressures of progress.
And joining us again from Vancouver, BC, Ronald Wright, author of A Short History of Progress. Hello again.
Hello.
Well, before we get into tonight's discussion, I want to play a piece of tape from you. This comes from the 2011 documentary Surviving Progress, which is based on your book. Here's a short clip from that.
The poor people need more. There is no doubt about it. There is no discussion there. If you are average villager somewhere in Rajasthan or Punjab or Nigeria, you need more, period. There's a basic human decency compels you to say these people need more. More clean water, more basic food, more education for their children. The discussion closed, right, before it begins, right? But as far as us is concerned, we certainly could and should do with much, much, much less.
Okay, and to add to that, here's some statistics compiled by National Geographic magazine just this year. Take a look at this. The world population increased from 1 billion to 6 billion in 200 years. We've reached the 7 billion mark just this year, just after 12 years after hitting the 6 billion mark. 7 billion people, if we were all crammed in somewhere, would fill an area the size of Los Angeles. We have 5 people around the world being born every second, but only 2 people are dying per second. And our population is set to increase to 9 billion in just over 30 years by the year 2045. Ronald Wright, given all of that, how do we generate a public conversation about population growth when this issue so easily crosses into individual autonomy and religious belief?
Yeah, it's a very tricky one. Very few people want to talk about overpopulation, although it used to be a big subject. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, I can remember you would see bumper stickers that said, overpopulation is your baby, you know. And so people were taking it seriously then, but it has become a hot potato, partly for the reasons you mentioned, and of course because of the great disparity between rich and poor, and the fact that in the wealthy countries, population growth has in general fallen to or even below replacement rate, whereas in the poorer countries where people have no expectation of the basic necessities of life and therefore tend to have large families in the hope that a few of their children will survive to run the farm or whatever the business is and look after the parents in their old age. That's where the birth rates still remain very high, although it is worth noting that birth rates are falling, and there seems to be a clear correlation between greater prosperity, and not just prosperity, but greater social security, a sense that there is a government who will give you a pension, that there will be schools, that your daughters can go to school. Education of girls and women is very important in reducing the birth rate. And then, of course, such things that Václav Schmil was just mentioning, clean water, safe sewage disposal, just the basic decencies of life. When those become widely available, birth rates fall pretty quickly. But unfortunately, we still have something like 2 billion people living on less than $1.50 a day. And 2 billion people is greater than the entire population of the world when Queen Victoria died, which is only, you know, just over a century ago. So that's not progress.
There is another way that birth rates decline, and China has tried this strategy, and it's one-child policy. Is that something you see as a useful strategy that other countries might want to try out?
Well, of course, China had the luxury of having a totalitarian system, and so they could enforce this policy in a way that would be unimaginable in, or extremely difficult to do in more democratic countries. It's worth noting also that India, which is to a large degree a democracy, perhaps not as democratic as we like to think, but it is somewhat democratic, India also had a rather draconian attempt to reduce fertility by sterilizing people. And I think actually that the Indian attempt was one of the things that got population control a bad name, because it tended to be the poor who were getting sterilized, and it also emerged that they were very often not really being told what was happening to them. So there's definitely a bit of a bad smell around the idea of enforced reductions in the birth rate by whatever means. However, we have to come to grips with the growing population. As I mentioned, the rate of increase has started to slow, but on a world level, it is still much too high. And we're going to end up at least 9 billion by mid-century, as you mentioned, and that is probably too many, because not only is it 2 billion more people, to mouths to feed, but it also, as the individual footprint of each person gets bigger, the impact on natural systems is likely to be much greater than simply going from 7 to 9. We're probably going to see, if present trends continue, we're going to see a doubling at least of the impact of human beings on the Earth's systems if we allow this to happen. And this is the other reason why it's so difficult to talk about population, because a poor person in Bangladesh is probably only having a 40th or a 50th of the effect on the Earth per head, than people in countries such as Canada, the United States, and the European countries. So there's this equation between absolute human numbers and the amount of consumption and waste generation per head.
And also part of that equation, though, is if we stick with the China example, you know, China's population is changing and growing, not to the extent that it might have. But now they're facing this conundrum by their one-child policy that by, you know, 2030, they're not going to have enough working-age citizens. So you're sort of solving perhaps one problem, but creating another social and problem and perhaps a more significant one, no?
Well, there are those people who say that you have to have a constantly growing population to keep the demographic pyramid, the sort of numbers of people in each age class, stable. And, you know, if you look at it purely in terms of economics and demographics, they have a point. On the other hand, though, we have one Earth. And quite clearly, you cannot allow human populations to keep on growing indefinitely. You know, it's even a very small rate of growth, like 1%, means a doubling every 70 years, that in one human lifetime. And 70 years is nothing in terms of the human career on Earth. So we have to bring the population down. I think there may be other ways to address this issue of, you know, not enough working age people supporting a large retirement population. That is obviously a bulge that is going to have to be gone through, just as, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, when world population was expanding at a very great rate, you had an enormous number of young people that had to be absorbed into society and jobs had to be found for them and so forth. And, you know, with varying degrees of success, that was achieved. And I think now we are going to see put in place structures that will enable us to deal with an older population for a while, but that's only a short-term problem. And it's much better to accept that short-term demographic problem than to allow things to continue to grow and therefore reap the whirlwind just a few generations down the road.
And another problem that we can throw into this equation of population growth is consumption. So where is the balance between, you know, sort of making the case for we've got to have fewer people on the planet versus the argument for, like, let's just stop consuming as much? Because when you look at countries like China and India, if they sort of ramp up to the consumption levels that we have here in the West, we're in a really sticky situation.
Well, yes, I think most people would agree that, you know, if another 2 billion or 3 billion consumers come in at the Western level, that will certainly overload the Earth and cause general collapse worldwide. So, but on the other hand, it's sort of unfair to pick on these countries. I mean, even though the Chinese economy is now greater than the American economy, per capita, it is much, much less. So really, we in the prosperous, high-income countries, the wealthy countries, have to take the lead here. We cannot expect countries like India and China to limit their population and their consumption if we don't do the same here. And let us remember that the gulf between rich and poor, both within countries and between countries, has accelerated enormously in the past 30 years. And then, in fact, that gap between rich and poor was decreasing up until sometime in the 1960s or 70s, certainly within modern social democracies such as the European countries and Canada and the United States too, largely as a result of policies that were put in after the Second World War. It was seen as a bad thing to have too big a gap between rich and poor. And history tells us that it is a bad thing because it leads to revolution, leads to uprising, it leads to huge masses of people protesting in the streets. You know, I think the really sad thing is that what happened in the late 70s and early 80s is that the lessons of the first half of the 20th century were torn up by people who just didn't want to believe it anymore. You know, 100 million people at least died in the 20th century's wars, and the lesson of that terrible bloodletting was that if you don't want Bolshevism, anarchism, Nazism, any of these extreme, desperate movements that get people out onto the fighting in the streets. If you don't want those things, you cannot have unregulated capitalism that tends to always, when it's unregulated, the wealth always goes to the top, leaving people at the bottom in desperate circumstances and very often without work. And when you've got a lot of young people without work, what do? They get out on the street. They go into crime, and eventually crime develops into unrest, and unrest becomes revolution. That was the lesson of the first half of the 20th century. So after the Second World War, we created the welfare states, and we brought in the Keynesian ideas of economics, that you taxed the people at the top and you redistributed that wealth. So you subsidized healthcare through taxation. You subsidized public education, even at university level. When I went to university, I didn't have to pay tuition. All of this was done in the interests of the greater good and in keeping a reasonable spread between rich and poor. There's still plenty of rich people around, but the spread was reasonable. And that was something that had emerged from the very painful, bloody lessons of the first half of the 20th century. And then along came Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys and his disciples, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and they just said, well, why do we need all this regulation? Let's just get rid of it and let capitalism rich, and everybody will get... let capitalism rip, and everybody will get rich, and it'll trickle down, and we'll get rid of poverty that way. Well, 30 years later, has that worked? I don't think so. We have, you know, 2 billion people out of the 7 billion living in desperate straits, probably worse than anything that existed in the past.
Seems to me you're suggesting that capitalism itself might be a progress trap.
Unregulated, yes. You know, I'm not suggesting we go back to communism, but I am suggesting that regulated capitalism seems to be the best way forward, and that was the lesson learned as the result of the First and Second World Wars, that you can't let it rip because it will lead to war and revolution and militarism and so forth. You have to redistribute the wealth, you have to create a sense that everybody has a stake in the society and everybody receives something from the society. Obviously, you still have to reward effort, you still have to reward hard work and ingenuity, but you cannot go back to this sort of old-fashioned Victorian belief known as social Darwinism, where you just let the people at the bottom starve and die on the streets because that's all they deserve anyway. You know, that is the sort of old way of thinking that led us into so much bloodshed and which we have to abandon. And we've learned that lesson, well, twice really, with two world wars, and we were actually implementing policies to affect this, and then it all got torn up with the emergence of the new right, which seems to me to be getting increasingly extreme, and which is advocating the very worst forms of progress. In other words, you know, ripping fossil fuels out of the ground as fast as you can, selling, doing it with very minimal environmental controls. We're now.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.